elephant ropes. The more you know about the causes of your own fear, the less ground Marv has to stand on, and the less his arguments will remain convincing. An elephant rope could be something as seemingly insignificant as your father telling you to stop making so much goddamn noise when you were singing in the back seat of the car. A note to parents, it takes only one incident like that to shut down a lifetime of singing. Describe this experience with as much detail as 5 minutes will allow. The more particulars, the better. Sights, sounds, smells, dates, times, all of it. Be as descriptive as possible. Real-world applications. This BBO is particularly helpful when you have a goal in mind that you just can't seem to find time to act on. What you're feeling is fear, not a crisis of time management. It's your elephant ropes that are making the goal seem way more daunting than it actually is. Let's say, for example, that you want to deepen your relationship with your older sister. You really want to call her, but it's been a while. You've had some difficulty communicating with her in the past, and you're not sure how the conversation will go. You're thinking that you need time to make this happen, a large block of time, perhaps, that you don't currently have. I want to remind you, the call has nothing to do with time. It has to do with Marv setting up emotional roadblocks. Do this BBO and see how your perspective changes. Chapter 3, A Man in Marv's Grip. The Many Ways We Fool Ourselves. My cousin and longtime bandmate Jeff Victor is a musical genius. Understand that I'm very judicious with the G word. I don't bring it out often, and when I do, it's only for the sake of precision, not flattery or hyperbole. As musicians' minds go, Jeff's doesn't merely melodize or harmonize, it orchestrates. His mind churns so fast and so consistently overflows with musical ideas that it disturbs his sleep. He's a pianist and a tremendous singer, and he composes songs and instrumental music. He also happens to be one of the funniest people I've ever met. Jeff's dream is to perform a concert of his original music. He's been a sideman forever, playing keyboards with dozens of local and national acts, but it's been more than 30 years since he's played his own music on stage. His dream is nothing huge, at least not to me. It's just a club date in his hometown of Minneapolis, or is it? Here's the problem. He can't seem to just do it. He tells me he doesn't have the time, the self-discipline, or the drive. Maybe that's true, but I don't believe any of those things. I think he's lying to himself. I think Marv's got him cornered. No doubt there would be some work needed on his part, and a few logistical things to take care of before a Jeff Victor show actually materialized. But I assure you, there's nothing earth-shattering stopping him. Just a few small actions to be taken in the present. Here's what he'd need to do. Select some pieces of music, maybe 10 or 12, to perform a set. He's got dozens of pieces of music. Rehearse with a band. He knows all sorts of excellent players who would play with him in a heartbeat. Contact a club owner or a local promoter. He knows everyone in town, and he's very popular in the Minneapolis music scene. Pick a performance date and alert some friends and fans. And finally, he'd need to sit his butt down on the piano bench and play the concert. If you look at this list, perhaps you're struck, as I am, at the ridiculously easy path that connects Jeff and his dream. It's not as though he wants to become a doctor and perform open-heart surgery in his own medical reality show. Or if you prefer, he's not planning the Jeff Victor world tour with a dozen semis, two tour buses, and a backup choir. It's just a gig at a club in his hometown. Jeff simply dreams of doing something that's literally a phone call away. So why is it that he can't make this happen? What has Marv said to him, and why is it so compelling, so constricting, so controlling? As we'll see, Marv has Jeff ensnared in a clever distraction that's short on content, but long on stifling contentment. Tops on the to-do list. Make a to-do list. Here's something about Jeff that's interesting to note. He's a compulsive list maker and planner. He'll make handwritten lists of things he needs to accomplish, things like pack underwear for trip, buy new toothpaste, find blue sweater, call dad about snowblower, make sure ice trays aren't leaking, buy new blades for electric shaver, sell Vox Jaguar Electric Oregon, return green plastic rake to Target, get extra hose for backyard, take vitamin D tablets, buy Paul Mitchell shampoo for oily hair, pack dress socks. Jeff's lists illustrate the frenzied minutia of his daily life. What's more, the list items never get finished from day to day, and they start to accumulate until this great heap of hundreds of things that can never get done morphs into a small mountain on his desk. But it's more than just paper. It's become a testament that proves, to Jeff at least, that it's impossible to truly accomplish anything resembling a dream. Yet, are the lists simply how he avoids actually doing anything while convincing himself he's doing something? They are specific, unbearably specific, but they're not present or true. There's nothing about the items on that list that forces the tasks to get completed or even started in the present. Many of the items on the lists are months old. Worst of all, they're all things he can push off to some time in the near or distant future. There's also nothing in the reams of chores that suggests any of them reflect Jeff's true aspirations. Now stop and reflect. How often have you cleaned out a file cabinet or email inbox or organized a sock drawer while something of far greater significance goes neglected? Nothing in a Jeff Victor list alludes to his desire to perform a concert, for example. Nothing relates to anything he's actually passionate about. These bullet points of busy work exist only to distract him from doing what he truly wants to do but truly fears doing. Keep in mind, Jeff is an incredibly accomplished pianist, composer, and arranger. And once, when he was young, he boasted enough patience and passion to get those incredibly complex skills under his belt in the first place. Jeff started playing piano in earnest around 8th grade. Where was Marv then? How come he couldn't stop Jeff from learning to play the piano? Why didn't Jeff quit through the hours of grueling lessons and repetitive practice drills? And what happened to Jeff in later years that prevents him from doing something we'd all regard as pretty simple, at least for a talented musician, putting on a performance? To put a fine point on it, when and why did Jeff stop listening to the music in his mind and in his heart and start listening to Marv? And how did Jeff forget his creative identity, so much so that in terms of his own simple dream, this prodigious talent no longer thinks of himself as Jeff Victor, but as Jeff Loser? A Tale of Love and Fear. I asked Jeff what he loves about creating music, and he described how it makes him feel calm, in a place beyond confidence, a state of pure being. He started taking lessons when he was 5, but he didn't like to read music. What he found was that he could listen to his teacher play, come back the next week, and play the piece by ear perfectly. It wasn't discipline that was driving him to practice. It was sheer love of the instrument. By his own admission, he had no discipline whatsoever. He loved to sing as he played, and the more he sang and played, the more he started to recognize relationships from one chord to the next and how it made him feel. He started to appreciate chords and harmony. He just loved how his fingers felt on the keys. In telling his story, not once did he mention a word about lists or time management. When I finally got to the million-dollar question of how he felt about doing his solo show, I could feel him bouncing clear out of his comfort zone. His breathing and his body language changed. It was as if he'd physically tightened. There was a palpable hesitation in his voice as he stammered, "I feel very confident, with the slight hesitation of, well, more than slight hesitation about my vocals." Then, when I asked him about his level of drive to perform the show, he just looked out the window and stared for a while before answering. If a 10 is, "I will not let anything get in my way, not money, not sleep, not family, and a one is I don't have any desire, like if I die and don't play this show, I won't regret not having done it, I would say I'm probably at around a five. To me, all that calculating sounded like Jeff was simply afraid. Afraid no one would like his show. Afraid no one would like him. And when I asked him about it, he agreed. Look, he told me, if I knew it would be enormously successful, I'd drop just about everything I'm currently doing. I'd do a lot of things differently if I knew I'd be an enormous success. Think about that statement for a moment. We'd all like to eliminate fear before we try something new. When we were young, we felt fear, but somehow it didn't stop us. There wasn't a clear point where it was simply gone. We had a fear, but we'd just do what we wanted anyway. We've all been there. We've all felt that sort of impervious, childlike innocence, and then somewhere along the line it goes missing, and it feels like something we can't regain, a paradise lost. Ask yourself what happened to your own childlike sense of belief and your ability to make your dreams manifest. Our run-ins with failure, contraction, have given us a surplus of caution. We've somehow internalized the idea that the reward for following our dreams is not adequate compensation for the pain we experience when things don't work out as we hoped they would. But is this conclusion something we've arrived at with true deliberation, or is it some subconscious non-decision? I asked Jeff, if you were to take a first step towards playing a concert, what would it be? That's when he launched into this somewhat convoluted explanation. I drew up a list of 12 songs a while ago, which I can't seem to find. Maybe they're in storage. I don't know. Well, I'll probably need to give some thought as to how I'd pull it all off technically, too. Well, let's say I have recordings that I like to use as backing tracks to reproduce what's on my CDs. For example, how many people I have in the band, or do I do it alone, or wait, maybe there'd be like 12 musicians on stage, or do I play all instrumental music, or do I sing, or... Can you hear how confusing Jeff is making things? There's nothing specific about what he's just told me. There isn't any clear first goal. And when you're looking to accomplish a goal, that kind of confusion is where the trouble usually starts. Jeff, can you give me just a tiny first step, I asked. One small piece that you can do to move this along. Something you can do in 5 minutes or less. He looked at me and said, you mean what I just said now wasn't small? In fact, it wasn't small or specific. It was all over the place and was very confusing. In Jeff's case, an example of a small step I'm looking for would be to take 5 minutes to find that missing list of songs, or, if he can't find it, to sit down and write a new one. Either one would constitute a small, specific, and actionable step. But then, as if not hearing a word I'd said, he dove straight back into unnecessary complexity. Okay, he agreed. That makes sense. I get it. But now, how am I going to do these songs? Am I going to use tape backing synced up to the live music mixed together to create a big sound that I enjoy? Or should I pare it down? Who am I going to call to play these songs? And how much are they going to charge me? That's when I felt I needed to jump in and give Jeff some more concrete examples of what those small steps look and feel like. If you don't know what to look for, you won't ever find it. One other specific and actionable idea would be for Jeff to give himself 10 minutes to go through each song on his list, once he's found it or rewritten it, and think about a possible sound for each song, to think about what might be best for him in terms of arrangement or style. It might look something like this. Excuse my ridiculous made-up titles. Reaction 91. Do this as an up-tempo rocker. Buttercup Deliverance, slow ballad style. Mrs. Hemingway's Hat, solo piano. Metallurgical Mistake, hard rock. Drowning in Sand, definitely Americana rock. Jeff thought for a while, and I could feel the wheels of his prodigious brain turning. None of what you're saying is difficult, he finally said. I'm just worried I don't have the time. time, that lamest of justifications, although merely thinking about a possible musical choice for each of the 12 songs would happen almost instantaneously for a musician as skilled as Jeff, I wasn't surprised to hear him obfuscating what should normally be a very simple process by pulling out the classic time excuse. And so he continued in the same sort of muddled vein. I was averse to interrupting, but I asked him how long it would take just to think of a possible musical direction, and he told me what I'd already known. It would take 2 seconds per song. I knew then that Jeff understood exactly the point I'd been trying to make. Our not being able to pursue our ideas is almost never about a lack of time. It's all about Marv and his eloquent expressions of fear. And when you want to accomplish a goal, you can't wait around for Marv to suddenly become fearless. In fact, he never will until you take action. Jeff needed to bring the concert into existence by picking something he could actually do in a very short time. Start there. Even if what that amounted to was only planning for the future, that was something he agreed he could do. "Here's the thing," I said to him. "I think you're absolutely terrified of doing this concert. Instead of just admitting that you're afraid, you're creating all this confusion so that you'll never have to be on the hook for actually having to do this concert. You're making it so difficult it'll never happen." He looked up at me. "Yeah," he said. "I guess I don't think I'm good enough." Feedback, fear, and reframing. What Jeff's story can teach us. We'll come back to Jeff Victor in a bit, but for now, let's distill a few lessons from his experience to use on our creative journeys. As we do this, let's resist the temptation to label or judge him. That wouldn't help him, or us, to realize prize dreams. Obviously, Jeff needs less rumination and more action. He's also allowed Marv to turn rain puddles into raging seas. But Jeff is honest enough to admit that he's afraid and confused. It's an insidious cycle. His confusion leads to fear, which feeds his confusion, which multiplies his fear, and so on. Let's outline 3 steps that could help him gain some clarity. Reframing. Jeff has to go back to the very beginning as though dreaming the concert for the first time. Whatever his roadblocks or objections, he has a chance to start over and reframe things. As he correctly surmised, he must ask himself, "How bad do I want this show?" But now he needs to ask himself this question as if nothing's standing in his way, and as if he's never been blocked about it. He needs to wipe the slate clean before reconsidering whether the dream of doing a show still holds appeal. That's crucial. If he asks the question from his current perspective, Marv will cut him off with 30 years' worth of ready-made excuses. Reinforcement. Now Jeff needs enticement and excitement. Rather than think, the left brain specialty, he needs to dream, the right brain specialty. To do that, he must let go and visualize himself on stage at that show. What will this look and sound like? Can he see the smiling faces and hear the enthusiastic applause? Who's playing with him? This imagined scene is the beginning of Jeff's being able to see his dream in a positive light. Reporting. People who try to lose weight or exercise in the gym know it goes much better when they have a workout partner or a spotter. Maybe Jeff needs just such a spotter, a coach, to check in with as he breaks the dream into action steps. Having someone to hold him accountable will help keep him focused on things that matter and set aside distractions that don't. Once Jeff has these steps accomplished, he needs to break the elephant rope for good with these 3 additional actions. Regroup. Now, Jeff might expand his circle with musicians who are positive and supportive, who will encourage him to press on toward the mark. At this point, Jeff needs to get himself into a room playing his music with people who love his work. The dream is feeling more real all the time. Reality check. Set a due date. The positive pressure of a due date does 2 things. First, it reminds Jeff's fearful self, his Marv, that this woolly mammoth will go away by a certain date and time. And second, it creates more positive pressure for Jeff to focus on what matters, to get ready for the show. Reassurance. Don't sweat the outcome. Jeff Victor knows how to let go as a musician. As he said, I get calm. I'm somewhere in a place beyond confidence. I'm not trying to do anything. I'm being. What Jeff is relating is that sense of fearless nothing that I described in the previous chapter. It's the perfect exemplar of Auden's line, poetry makes nothing happen. He needs to have a similar detachment in regard to his perfectionism, wanting to play the perfect set with the perfect songs and the perfect musical cast, and treat the set as equal parts experiment and experience. Finally, Jeff needs leverage. Marv will try to bully him at every step, but there's an old proverb that says, the one thing the devil can't stand is being mocked. If Jeff can laugh at himself and treat the destination for what it is, just one concert on one day in his life, his demons will shrink away. Being aware, truly aware of Marv and his antics, is the first step in disempowering him. If Jeff had even a trace of objectivity, he'd find the whole thing more hilarious than intimidating. By getting and staying specific, present, and true, Jeff Victor can finally concentrate not on the nightmares, but on living out his dream concert. Let's see what life would look like for him if he were free to pursue what he truly loves. When I asked Jeff what a brilliant performance in which people stood up and clapped for him would feel like, he had this to say. It'd feel fantastic. I would have unrivaled sex with my wife. I would be more funny, more creative, and lighthearted with my children. And I would be motivated to do a lot more musical performances. It would put me on a high. An unparalleled high, I would turn into the best version of myself I could possibly imagine. For those of you looking for a postscript to Jeff's story, you should know that he made his dream come true on a wintry Saturday night, opening for another musician at a small club in Excelsior, Minnesota. He'd taken a specific, present, and true approach, and instead of being incapacitated with anxiety, as he had been when he was just thinking about the project, he followed his goal through to completion. It was as if Marv's negative voice had entirely disappeared. Not only was Jeff's playing and singing amazing, as I knew it would be, he reported, being on stage was like entering a portal where everything was pure joy and possibility. The hour and 15-minute performance passed without his even noticing it. In his words, I've never felt so happy and free in all my life. Brain Bottle Opener 3, Marv's Furlough Notice. Take 3 minutes to write a note to Marv that tells him why you're going to be sending him on regular, daily vacations. It could sound something like this. Dear Marv, you're a great guy, and I want you to know that I appreciate everything you've been doing for me all these years. All the protection you provided me has been an invaluable addition to my well-being. In consideration of all that, I'm going to allow you much more free time. I'm going to be doing, name your dream, from now on, and I want you to know that I'll be okay. Please save your strength for times when I really need it. For example, should I ever fall from the deck of an ocean liner, please help me scream and swim, and if I ever find myself being chased by a puma, please help me run. But unless those kinds of things should happen, please feel free to lounge about all day, eat, read, go for a walk, whatever it is you need to do, now is the time to do it. Okay? Your friend, Peter. Real World Applications. This BBO is perfect for those times when you feel a lack of confidence, when you break your dream into small, specific parts that are practical and doable. Confidence becomes a totally irrelevant factor. For example, let's say you want to learn to play the piano. A small, really small but important, specific step would be to look up the names of piano teachers in your area and check out their references. This does not require some special skill. Doing Marv's furlough notice is a good way to gain impetus to engage in that simple step. Chapter 4, Meet the Deflators. The challenge continues. Have you ever noticed that the stories we tell ourselves to deflect from acting on our dreams are actually highly creative? They've got great hooks, nuanced character development, breathtaking cinematography, and incredible dialogue. It's almost as if Marv has a team of brilliant filmmakers at his disposal. Let's call them the Deflators, whose primary goal is to engage our imagination for the sole purpose of discouraging our imagination. Talk about irony. The moment we get serious about a dream, Marv calls an emergency production meeting with the Deflators. Here are some of the notes from their production meeting back when I was getting started with Big Muse. "Look, Deflators, I'm afraid Peter's going to get himself into some serious trouble with this Big Muse idea of his. I need you guys to get busy with a movie we can project on the screen of his consciousness. We can even play the thing as he sleeps, but it's got to be convincing. It's got to make him understand that this business will fail, and he needs to see how much harm the failure is going to bring him. We've got to put him in touch with some of his most vulnerable childhood emotions." And here's an example of a little movie magic the Deflators put together for me. It was made of footage from when I was in first grade. It's winter. I'm walking home from the bus stop carrying a math quiz with one of the answers wrong. The incorrect answer represents the chance, however small, that my parents could stop loving me. I reason that if I'm not perfect, I might be left alone to freeze out here. My survival instinct kicks in. When I'm sure there's no one looking, I crush the paper into a ball and push it deep into the snowbank with the heel of my boot. In all fairness to my parents, I can't exactly say where those ideas came from. Maybe from fairy tales I'd read, maybe from some Disney movie, lots of traumatic stuff in those things. But the point is that those fears I experienced felt real. They actually caused me to lie and to hide the source of my shame, regardless of the fact that there wasn't a chance in hell I'd actually be rejected by my parents, let alone cast out into a Minnesota winter's night. But there you have it. The Deflators created a little cinematic gem, which on some hidden emotional level said, "Don't be less than perfect, or you might die." These kinds of negative thoughts are very seductive, and without some means of interdiction, they have a way of slowly draining the air out of your dreams. You need to be aware of how your own mind works and catch yourself before you get too far down the negativity track as you begin working on an idea. Recalling the Zen tradition I mentioned earlier, maintaining a sense of being an observer, that is, being able to relax and see what's happening around you without falling into a stew of raw emotions, is key. One trick you can do anytime and anywhere to relax your mind is to take 3 very deep, very slow breaths. Try slowly breathing in through your nose and out through pursed lips as though you were exhaling through a straw. I find myself doing this several times during the day, and it works wonders. When you are relaxed, you can begin to bear witness to how your mind works. By maintaining a calm objectivity, you stay free to act in the moment. But beware, oftentimes the more creative we get, the more creative the Deflators get. If we can stop and see them for what they really are, then we can enlist them in producing the movie we want to see. The ancient Greeks understood this concept. In the story of Orestes, the Furies are 3 monsters who attack and terrify Orestes day and night with their relentless criticism and ghoulish appearance, all because of a little family drama involving pride and murder Nothing like a little family dysfunction to get those furies hopping mad. Only when Orestes takes responsibility for his actions at a trial held by the gods do the furies transform into fairies or Eumenides that guide Orestes as wise, loving spirits. Thousands of years old, this myth speaks volumes about the most basic creative dilemma of all. Do we succumb to the voices that haunt us, or do we take accountability for our lives and dreams and take action? Even though they were vexing, Orestes didn't angrily banish the Furies. He accepted personal responsibility, reflected on the Furies' positive virtues, and only then were they transformed into wise guides. We break the cycle when we recognize what's taking place in our minds, when we understand that the negative feelings that crop up to quell our dreams are really the products of our own fruitful imaginations. We need only begin to take the small actions toward our goals to break away from the negativity. When we do that, we change the deflator's directives and orientation. Then they immediately bring their awesome skills and come to work for us. Designing a dream. Meet Andy Cruz, a talented graphic designer and illustrator. He's made a nice living for himself working in the advertising industry in Los Angeles. In the past several years, the economics of producing images have undergone seismic shifts because of the abundance of excellent and inexpensive design software that allows almost anyone to create professional-looking layouts and graphics. As a result, Andy's job, his sense of himself, and the direction he needs to go next have been trod upon. Some days he maintains a clear vision of just what he needs to do to make a change. Other days, it all seems so confusing. Andy is afraid he might lose his job. He figures he has 8 months to a year before it ends, but he hasn't yet begun to seriously look elsewhere. He's put feelers out, inquired about similar positions, but he hasn't shifted into action mode. What he really needs, he says, is a business plan to get organized, something he's never really done before. So I asked him to describe what this business might look like. I don't see it as too much different from what I'm doing now, doing custom design and illustration for clients and having a big, nice library of stuff to license to people. But I keep asking myself, am I really good enough? Is it current? Is it going to touch somebody emotionally? I was curious why Andy had such a negative attitude. He called it a function of his personality. When he's in a kind of in-between place, as he puts it, he's far more susceptible to feeling like no one's going to value his work. When I asked him if he'd shown his new stuff to anyone, even a single person, he told me exactly what I'd expected. Not a soul. How many times, growing up, have you heard the phrase, "You can't know unless you try"? How is it that we often feel we know with certainty that we're not good enough? When you see someone, a friend, your spouse, or a child, rationalizing his or her own inaction, it's so often obviously illogical. But when it's you, 100% negative outcome is the sanest thing you've ever heard. Consider this. How many times in your life has an answer to a question boiled down to making contact, making a phone call? What stops you from the simple act of dialing? I wondered how Andy would feel if instead of thinking about all the possible ways he could fail, he just took it upon himself to call someone he'd worked with successfully in the past, simply dialed 10 digits that afternoon. What would it be like, I asked, if you got a positive response like, "Hey, yeah, let's meet early for lunch next week"? For Andy, the answer was easy. "That would definitely give me hope," he said. I also wondered if he felt there was a good chance someone would want to meet with him. As I anticipated, Andy brightened a bit and said, "Yeah, of course. I'm almost 95% certain I could get at least one of my past clients on the phone." A moment before, Andy was so certain of what the results would be if he tried reaching out to one of his past clients that he didn't even see the point in bothering. How did the number go from 100% negative to 95% positive? Let's focus on the positive a little longer. I asked Andy to think a bit more about how a yes might change his outlook, to imagine the lunch or the setup to the lunch, and how he might begin to think about pitching the idea of working for a past client if he knew a meeting was imminent. To that, he said, if I had a good response to my request for the meeting, it would be a complete change for the better. Now, I'll bet you're thinking exactly what I was thinking. It seems so simple. Just shut the hell up and call the guy. But as it always does when Marv is steering the ship, what should be simple becomes complicated. Instead of moving forward with a task as easy as dialing up a satisfied past client, Andy's fear took over. See if the confusion he's sowing in this next paragraph sounds the least bit familiar. One of the people that I'd love to call just got a new position in San Francisco, but he's so high up in the company he probably doesn't even have anything to do with finding a new illustrator or anything like that. I'm not sure he's even the right guy to be speaking with at this point. I wonder if he'd even remember me. Maybe I should call this one guy who used to know him, and he could sort of reintroduce us, but then I don't even know where to find that guy anymore. This is a perfect example of complexity in place of simplicity. It's Marv's stock and trade. At that point, I put my hand on Andy's shoulder to sort of ease him out of his fear trance. And in a quiet, steady voice, I said, look, just call the guy. Call him, book a flight, and get the hell up there. It was as if a bell had rung inside Andy's head. You know, he said, I've been way overthinking this. My relationship with him is actually pretty solid. Not like best buddies or anything, but it's good enough that if I were to say, hey, I'm going to be in town on this day, is there any way we could grab a lunch or a coffee? In fact, I'm 100% certain that even if the guy's super busy, he'd be willing to give me 20 minutes for a cup of coffee. Now Andy's gone from a 95% expected success rate to 100%. When you look at your situation as this huge, nebulous blob of confusion and doubt and fear, you will invariably feel as if you can't achieve your goals. Negativity thrives in that confusion. But when you start to punch in those 10 numbers, make that call, take that action, whatever it may be, the fear naturally abates. I could hear the tone in Andy's voice lighten as he contemplated the implications of this simple act, dialing a series of 10 numbers, and how it could really change everything about the way he was looking at his future. The simplicity of the action is key because it doesn't give fear time to impose itself. Once the meeting is set, you're already marshaling your resources, those images you need to get together, that portfolio of artwork, rewriting your resume, compiling case studies or architectural renderings, whatever they are, you will get them together. Postscript to Andy's story. While he didn't end up connecting with his contact in San Francisco, 3 weeks after my conversation with him, Andy emailed a friend who'd recently taken a job at a media company in the San Fernando Valley. That email led to his scheduling a meeting with the friend's boss, which led to Andy compiling a portfolio of his older and more current work. There was a good fit, and I'm happy to report that Andy is now working as part of a select team of designers creating online marketing materials for Fortune 500 clients. Brain Bottle Opener 4, Fear Reduction Benefits. We know what fear wants to see. What do you want to see instead? Try this. Take 3 minutes to write down a list of ways that letting go of some of your fear would positively impact your life. Don't list external benefits such as fame, wealth, or power. I'm talking about subtle internal benefits. For example, let's say you have a dream of owning your own snowboarding school. How would getting over your fear about finally taking the concrete steps towards owning the snowboarding school affect your overall mood, your sense of self, your relationship with your spouse or your parents. An internal benefit might read something like this. Reducing my attention to fear would allow me to create my own snowboarding school. With a thriving business, I would wake up in the morning on top of that mountain with a strong sense of purpose, knowing that I'm bringing joy to others. Let's say your goal is to ask your boss for a raise. Your internal benefit might sound something like this. If I stop being swept away by my fears, I could finally lay out an argument that would make my boss see why I deserve a raise. I would not only bring in some much-needed extra money, it would make me feel like I was taking more control over my own life. I would feel a greater sense of pride, and that pride would translate to my being able to show more affection to my family. Real-world applications. This BBO is particularly useful when you're trying to find the strength to start something that's particularly fearful for you. If you're a teacher and have to deliver an important lecture to your class the next morning, or you have to give a presentation at work in front of your board, creating this list of fear reduction benefits will help. You will be able to push back against your fear-filled vision and replace it with your own scenario of a positive outcome, one that derives from having more volition and subsequently more power to bring your ideas to fruition. Part 1 Review. Before we move forward into the next part of the book, take a moment to reflect on what you have accomplished so far through these 4 brain bottle openers. You have written a why you letter that boldly states what you believe your life's purpose is. If you are unable to write this, you should know that's good too. Knowing what you don't know is always helpful. You have explored one of your elephant ropes, an experience from your vulnerable past that holds you back today. Just being aware of what might rightly be considered Marv's main ammunition, your fearful memories, is a way of diminishing his power. You've done just that. You've written Marv's furlough notice, explaining to him just why you're going to be giving him time off. Look, I know it's just a metaphor. There's not really a guy named Marv in your head, at least no neuroscientist that I'm aware of has found him yet. But what you've done in this BBO is reinforce your ability to take control of your destiny by gently, always gently, removing his authority. You've made a list of fear reduction benefits. You create and maintain a positive state of mind by understanding the ways your life could change for the better if you were able to significantly reduce your attention to fear. Now let's focus on the rewards of minimizing our fear. Part 2, the rewards. We're so engaged in doing things to achieve purposes of outer value that we forget the inner value. The rapture that is associated with being alive is what it is all about. Joseph Campbell. Chapter 5, The Taste of Victory. Milky Way Moments Explained. Okay, it's time for slightly odd metaphors. Stay with me. Imagine that your boundless joy, the kind you get when you sense that your life overflows with endless possibilities, is like the unfathomable reaches of the Milky Way galaxy. Picture the heavens, majestic with white-hot stars, each of them shining on you in your dreams for a brighter future. You are aloft, weightless, impossibly free-spirited, and brimming with hope. Or, if astronomy isn't your thing, then let's imagine that same boundless joy as a gigantic Milky Way candy bar. Picture that sucker. It's huge, maybe 12 feet long, 3 feet wide, and 2 feet tall. It's laid out on some enormous picnic table, and it represents the kind of ecstasy I just described, all chocolate, caramel, and pure unfettered creative nougat. That's the kind of exquisite gratification you get as soon as you become engrossed and the small actions that make the manifestation of a dream possible. I call that feeling a Milky Way moment. Let's say that becoming a world-class musician is your goal. Now imagine you're a kid and you play the violin. You have a vision of yourself playing Carnegie Hall one day. Here's the thing about Milky Way moments. You don't get them only when you make it to Carnegie Hall. After 15 years of grueling practice and a good bit of luck, you get them the moment you become engaged in the experience. In this case, the experience of making music. The Milky Way moment could happen while you're practicing by yourself. It could happen when you're carried away listening to Jascha Heifetz playing Paganini's Caprice No. 24. Or it could happen at a performance for your 8th grade student body. The size of the venue doesn't make any difference. If you're consumed by the experience of making music, your body and mind will go through the same sensations, whether you're playing for 12 people at your local church or that dream gig at Carnegie Hall. Engaging in the small steps of bringing your dream into focus is what brings you to your Milky Way moment. This is true no matter what your dream is. That's not to say that thinking about monetary compensation, improved social status, or whatever reward you might want to accrue from a certain goal is a bad thing. But the very human need to experience a sense of accomplishment is the essence of the Milky Way moment. And we achieve that feeling when we go from the anxious mulling to the act of doing. When we participate in simple actions rather than worried considerations, we gain a sense of comfort in seeing that we've finally shown some agency and taken some control. That's when Marv can become an ally, a mix of Jung's golden shadow and a benevolent critic, helping us polish our nascent efforts until they shine. Take Andrea Kern from Pasadena, California. 32 years old and married with one daughter, she recently got her real estate license and has long wanted to start a blog on the best way to sell a home in her area. Today, she decided to make that small goal a reality. Here's what she did. 9:25 a.m., she called a friend and said, "Hey, I'm starting my blog this morning." 9:30 a.m., she went online and started reading some blogs from other writers for inspiration. 9:45 a.m., she gave herself 5 minutes to jot down some ideas she thought might interest potential clients. 9:50 a.m., she gave herself a 40-minute deadline to complete her first short blog. Time limits are very comforting to an anxious mind. How much trouble can you get into in 40 minutes after all? Now, here's what she didn't do. Daydream about wanting to write a blog. Decide that she needed to stop writing and call her friend back. Watch 3 hours of cooking shows on Hulu. Keep the idea of writing a blog to herself to prevent embarrassment in case she didn't actually go through with it. Andrea started. She didn't just think about starting a blog. Through the force of her will, she drew a line connecting dream to reality by taking specific actions in the here and now. Simple as that. She didn't wait for lightning bolts of inspiration. She simply got to it, and the Milky Way moment was already hers. Now we understand that when Andrea sat at her kitchen table and turned on her laptop, she was already eating her Milky Way. She didn't need to become the most read blogger in Pasadena to start unwrapping her metaphoric candy bar. She didn't need to experience the end result. She needed only to start taking action, and Marv went off to read a novel. Endless possibilities arise when we take immediate action. Andrea is a naturally optimistic person, but that's not to say that midway through the process, she won't have many unwelcome visits from Marv. She will. But it does say that the joy of manifesting a dream doesn't come just at the end. The fruit of it, the Milky Way moments, come to you right from the start. But what if Andrea had never taken the precise steps towards writing the blog that led her to her Milky Way moment? What if she just stayed in the anxious, mulling it over zone? Last odd metaphor in this chapter, I promise. Imagine that beside the enormous Milky Way bar is a tiny, dried-out blade of grass. That tasteless, dried blade of grass represents the amount of pleasure you get from keeping your dreams safe inside your head, which, of course, is not much pleasure at all. It's just the measly consolation prize Marv gives you for not taking action. As opposed to the Milky Way bar in all its chocolicious splendor, there's no wonderful fragrance from the metaphoric dried blade of grass. You can't get a sugar rush from it. The only thing you can do with it is say, "Won't life be great when I finally get around to," insert your dream here. No, it's not a lot of pleasure, certainly not compared with the humongous Milky Way bar. There is actually one other thing you can do with that worthless dried blade of grass. You can sit around and criticize the people who are having their Milky Way moments. You can grouse about how much better you'd be if you had a chance to write that song, or act in that movie, or start that business, or write that blog. Now, it would be a lie to say that this kind of passive aggressiveness yields no delight whatsoever. The truth is that it does, sort of. It gives you pleasure perfectly commensurate with a tiny piece of dried grass. Not much, is it? One reason we so often opt for the grass, i.e., choose not to act on our dream, is that there's no public shame in not trying. Sure, we might feel bad when we compare ourselves to the Milky Way people, but there's not really any loss involved. We never tried, so we never failed. A most profound Milky Way moment. One of the greatest rewards for taking control of your own thinking, which is exactly what you're doing when you learn to reduce your sense of fear, is that you will instantly become more creative. Understand that by using the term creative, I don't mean that you'll suddenly have mastery of any particular skill. What I mean is that the more fearless you can become, the more you will reveal your authentic self. You will act in the here and now. You will have more unfettered access to your previously acquired skill sets, and you will be responsive to what's happening around you. This freedom to act is one of the underpinnings of creativity itself. It is, for example, a quality that a jazz pianist must have to be able to improvise well. One of the most effective methods of eliminating fear is to develop a more profound relationship with the people you love. Science has shown that focusing your creativity on elevating and maintaining those bonds results in the greatest level of overall happiness. Yes, love can make you a more creative person. Professor and author Barbara L. Fredrickson is the director of the Positive Emotions and Psychophysiology Laboratory at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Fredrickson is known for her pioneering research on the long-lasting emotional benefits of human interconnection. She writes about an interesting behavioral quirk called hedonic adaptation. Simply put, this means that people who win the lottery, for example, find that after a short while, they're no happier than they were before they struck it rich. That's because they've adapted to the change. According to Professor Fredrickson, our relationships with the people we love, unlike our relationship with fame or material gain, are not subject to hedonic adaptation. The positive emotions that accrue from them can last a lifetime. We simply don't adapt to the deep bonds we have with people like we do with a new car or a first-class plane ticket. Our interactions with loved ones continue to be profound. They uplift us even with the passage of time. Being generous, expressive, and humble is how we make our relationships strong. When they're strong, we become strong and better able to make our ideas take shape. Here is a story about how I once told my dad something so important it changed my entire life. In 1978, I graduated high school, and the romantic poetry from Prince's song Soft and Wet off his debut album piqued my imagination. How overt, I wondered, could you possibly get with song lyrics? Inspired by Prince, I wrote several songs, thinking, it's so damn simple. I can write like this and get famous, too. Here are the choruses to some of the songs I wrote. Fireman. I'm your fireman, show me where you're burning. I'm your fireman, ooh baby, I'm coming. I'm your fireman, show me where you're burning, and I'll be there to hose you down. Torture me. Torture me all night long. Love me tough, love me strong. I'll be your victim till the break of dawn. Got to move a little faster. Baby, let me be your cigarette. Baby, let me be your cigarette. Come on, puffa, puffa, puffa till my tip gets wet. Light me up and baby, don't fret. 'Cause girl, I want to be your cigarette. While I was writing these works of genius and supposedly having the time of my life, I was in deep emotional pain. My dad discovered a lump in the back of his neck in the autumn of 1978. It took the doctors a week to determine that he had stage 4 lymphoma. They figured he had 6 months tops. At the time, I was an avid practitioner of transcendental meditation. One of its stated goals is that it can help to flatten the emotional highs and lows we normally experience. Because I'd barely reacted when I heard the news, I decided then and there that something that could make me this flat and non-responsive to what should have been devastating couldn't be good. I vowed to quit TM that very night. I understood later that it wasn't the TM that had flattened me, but my own propensity to go inside myself, to stay as far away from my feelings as possible. It was as if I'd been playing a sort of double role. On one hand, I remained hypersensitive and very connected to the grief I was experiencing. On the other, I was divorced from my emotions and totally shut down. Years later, toward the end of my dad's life, everything came crashing in as the two halves collided. It was 1983, and I was in Amory, Wisconsin. Our band had finished up its last set at a bar called the Country Dam. It was late, and the crowd was so drunk that they were falling over one another, screaming for one more chorus of Fireman. At 4 in the morning, I pulled up to my parents' house behind my dad's white 83 Chrysler LeBaron. He'd gone all the way to Mankato with my mother to buy this thing. Tired as I was, I couldn't stop looking at this car, wondering how I'd feel about it when he died. It was Father's Day, after all, and my mom had planned a big brunch for him in just a few hours. Cousins, aunts, and uncles, everybody wanted to be there and cheer him up. My mom had asked me to write something funny, some kind of cute ditty to lighten the mood. Even though my dad had outlived the doctor's dire predictions by 4 years, we knew that the cancer had progressed to the point where this was very likely his last Father's Day. I was still pretty wound up from the performance the night before, and since the sun was coming up anyway, I couldn't see any reason to try and sleep. I picked up a guitar. It was an old nylon string that hardly played in tune. I started picking through some chords in a half trance and began singing softly to myself, just thinking about that LeBaron and how my dad really liked it. The words came fast and the melody started to take on a shape. Each new line generated more melody, and the melody inspired more words. When no one is forgotten, and nothing goes to waste, when sadness turns to laughter, when anger is defaced, you'll start to know the way I feel about you. I knew from experience that when a song comes to you like that, it's best to get out of your own way, to be as detached as possible, and yet I couldn't help feeling excited that this was a song for my dad. I thought, at least now I won't be the only fool at the brunch without a Father's Day present. And if I could,